You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the complex world of enterprise identity, securing legacy web apps at scale can be daunting. Strata Identity makes it simple. With Strata, you can effortlessly integrate non-standard apps with any identity service, like MFA or SSO, with zero coding and zero hassle. Designed by identity architects for identity architects, Strata works with every vendor, standard, and app architecture. This means your apps can now speak modern protocols and integrate seamlessly with your chosen identity services. From securing on-prem web apps to migrating away from outdated identity providers or consolidating them, Strata helps you keep your complex access policies as you modernize your identity infrastructure and get rid of technical debt. Join leading organizations like 3M, Dallas County, and CIBC in securing your apps with Strata. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your identity security priorities, and receive a complimentary pair of AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Connect today at strata.io/cyberwire.
Upgraded voting machines may not be as secure or as upgraded as election officials seem to think. Criminals continue to exploit routers in Brazil. A Japanese cryptocurrency exchange shuts down while it investigates a multi-million dollar theft. The Federal Trade Commission fines Facebook $5 billion over privacy issues. Weekend power outages seem not to have been the result of cyber attacks. Another city sustains a ransomware attack. And shop carefully on Amazon Prime Day. From the CyberWire studios at Datatribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Monday, July 15, 2019. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has announced its determination to upgrade its election security before 2020, and it's spent more than $14 million in funds, mostly contributed to the state by the federal government, to do so. But this upgrade hasn't proceeded happily. The Associated Press reported in an exclusive over the weekend that county election authorities have, for the most part, gone with voting machines running Windows 7, an operating system that will reach its end of life in January. The systems are used, the AP says, quote, to create ballots, program voting machines, tally votes, and report counts, end quote. All of this is, as the engineers would delicately put it, suboptimal, and no one is particularly happy about it. U.S. Election Assistance Commission Chair Christy McCormick told the AP using Windows 7 systems, quote, is of concern and it should be of concern, end quote. The largest U.S. voting system vendor, ES&S, say they've got arguably more secure Windows 10-based systems coming soon and that they're working with Microsoft to provide Windows 7 security upgrades until all systems came to be converted to the latest version of the OS. This is not an unfamiliar problem with Internet of Things generally. Vendors modify operating systems in ways that tend to prolong their life beyond the intended limits. There may also be a standards issue here. County election officials tend to take certifications as solid evidence that their systems are secure. But the AP's story goes on to say that Citizens for Better Elections, an advocacy group, says that many county election officials seem to be unaware that many of the systems they intend to use were certified under 2005 standards. In any event, vulnerabilities in systems that count and report votes would open the possibility of direct manipulation of elections, a step beyond the kind of influence operations foreign actors have deployed in the past. Avast follows up the trend toward cross-site request forgery attacks against routers with a report on the exploit kits used. The attacks had been noted earlier by Radware and NetLab. Victims continue to be concentrated in Brazil. CoinDesk reports that Japanese altcoin exchange Bitpoint has halted all activity while it investigates the theft of some $32 million in cryptocurrency. The exchange noticed there was a problem when it observed anomalous behavior in a hot wallet. The Wall Street Journal reported late Friday that the U.S. Federal Trade Commission has approved a $5 billion settlement in the matter of Facebook privacy missteps in connection with the Cambridge Analytica data scandal. The commission divided along partisan lines in their vote. The three Republicans approved the FTC's proposed settlement, while the two Democrats saw things to dislike in it. The agreement, which now goes to the Department of Justice Civil Division for final review, is expected to include provisions for closer privacy oversight of the social network, but those details weren't immediately available. It's thought the partisan divide may have been over the character of the oversight measures. As heavy a burden as $5 billion may be, congressional critics of the fine point to Facebook's very high revenues, which were, the Washington Post notes, $15 billion for the last quarter alone. Facebook had expected a heavy fine, and in that same quarterly report said that it had put aside funds to cover that eventuality. Another way of looking at the matter is in terms of profit per employee. At Facebook, that's over $634,000 per employee per year, a record for the tech sector, according to Silicon Valley Business Journal. Nonetheless, it's hard to regard $5 billion as chump change, even around Menlo Park. The settlement easily sets a record for penalties imposed for violating an FTC order. The previous record was a $22.5 million fine against Google in 2012, which in relative terms is chicken feed. The FTC has greater latitude in punishing repeat offenders, and were Facebook not a privacy recidivist, it might have gotten off easier. On the other hand, a number of observers, including some members of Congress, think the penalty amounts to a slap on the wrist. An opinion piece in The Verge agrees, arguing that Facebook has behaved badly since its foundation, and that it has consistently escaped accountability for such missteps as those on display in the Cambridge Analytica affair. The GAO recently published a report, "Federal Agencies Need to Strengthen Online Identity Verification Processes," urging federal agencies to up their game when it comes to user authentication. Patrick Cox is founder of TrustID, a company that specializes in call authentication.
The traditional way, I say traditional, meaning maybe the last 10 or 15 years, the way authentication has worked in these channels is primarily asking questions, right? We all know the drill. What's your mother's maiden name? What's your date of birth? What's your social security number? Things like that. And that's broken. That's really what led us here today, is that that information is just totally broken.
And so what are the alternatives then?
Well, three ways to authenticate somebody. One, obviously, is asking them questions, and that's called knowledge-based identity proofing. The second one would be ownership. So you think about a credit card, a physical unique device, right? That would be ownership authentication, having a device, a key, for example, a key to a safety deposit box would be an ownership token. And the final one is what we'd call inherent, something you inherently are. So a fingerprint, a retinal scan, you know, a DNA, things like that would indicate who you are. Those are the only three tools we have in the authentication arsenal. So questioning, you know, is really easy to understand why you do that, especially over a phone call, because it's hard to, if not impossible, to get a fingerprint or something over a phone call, right? So it becomes more challenging.
I know one of the concerns here is that if you move to a digital method, if you do something that, you know, requires something like a mobile device, well, not everybody has a mobile device.
Absolutely true. And so what we've been advocating for, in fact, we do this millions and millions of times each day for some of the largest financial institutions in the country, is relying far less on the asking of questions, right? The knowledge information, that whole approach, frankly, is broken because criminals know your date of birth, right? It's on social media. It's been shared. the sad news with all the data breaches and hacks and so on out there, they have your social security number, they have your address, they have your mortgage payment information. The information has been shared with the bad guys. And so what we advocate for is using more ownership authentication. So if you're calling from a mobile phone, as you say, Dave, it's pretty common sense to say, hey, if we can make sure that mobile phone is unique, it's not duplicated, it's actually engaged in the interaction, it's in that person's possession because they've obviously used some sort of probably inheritance method, right? They've used a facial scan or a fingerprint or a passcode to get access to that phone. That's great. And then also it's nice, though, on a phone call, even if it's a landline, you can do the same thing for landline phones. Yes, which is great, right? Now you've got basically 100% coverage because if the person is able to call in, then they can identity proof with that ownership token, the phone itself. Doesn't have to just be mobile. It can be landline as well.
And is that like something as simple as a callback system where they're calling you so they know the number they're calling, or I guess using some sort of caller ID to verify the number you're calling from?
Yeah, so you'd use the caller ID information, which is great. However, you've probably heard of a thing called spoofing, where criminals and others can they can fake your phone number. So if you can solve for the spoofing problem, and there's technology today that does that, and also if you can solve for what we call the virtualization problem, and there's technology that solves that. When I say virtualization, think about calls from Skype or Google Voice, right? It's not really a physical device. It's not really a physical location. It's more of a virtual login, username, and password. You can deal with that technology and be able to identity proof these calls if you can solve for the spoofing and virtualization problems. And again, as I said, there's really proven technology out there to do those things.
That's Patrick Cox from Trust ID. Deutsche Welle reports that an unprecedented power failure yesterday affecting Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay remains under investigation. But Argentina's energy ministry says a cyber attack is not among the main alternatives being considered. MSNBC quotes New York City's Mayor de Blasio saying the city is as certain as we can be that Manhattan's weekend blackout was not caused by a cyber attack. Power has been largely restored in both instances. Official announcements concerning grid failures now routinely address the possibility of cyber attack. The Syracuse City School District in central New York State has confirmed that a cyber incident it sustained last week was, in fact, a ransomware attack. This is the most recent in a string of ransomware attacks against local governments and their services. Syracuse schools haven't yet brought their systems back online. The town of New Bedford, Massachusetts, also sustained a recent cyber attack, but the city is keeping quiet about the details, acting, it says, on the advice of the security consultants it's hired to help with recovery. And it's Amazon Prime Day, as you may have noticed. Even if you haven't noticed, the grifters, scammers, the hoods all have. Amazon Prime is being used as fish bait all over the place. So shop carefully. And joining me once again is Joe Kerrigan. He's from the Johns Hopkins University Information Security Institute and also my co-host over on the Hacking Humans podcast. Joe, it's good to have you back.
It's good to be back, Dave.
Joe, we have been following this story about Apple and Zoom, the right. conferencing software, and how Zoom had installed a web server on Macs, and if you uninstalled the Zoom app, this web server would stay behind.
Correct.
Zoom says to facilitate easier reinstallation
right.
Of the app.
Right. Well, the vulnerability actually stems from a problem with this ease of use feature, if you mm-hmm. want to call it that, that Zoom was insisting on. Now has since backtracked from it. But the idea that when I click the link, I just get it. Just works. Zoom just comes up, and I'm teleconferenced in.
Right.
And the
right.
link, the person who administers the Zoom conference can turn my camera on and my microphone on, so that presumably I don't have to sit there going, "How do I get my audio connections
right.
to work?" Just like I did this past Tuesday in a WebEx meeting.
Yeah, exactly.
That,
well,
that happened to
yeah,
me.
They are there. Yes,
I had to type in the chat and say, "Hold on, let me set my audio settings right."
Right? Mm-hmm. But yeah, we've all been through that for
right,
sure.
Exactly. And Zoom is from a user perspective saying, "Well, that's too much. Let's just do this." Well, that is also too much, apparently. But mm-hmm. really what's interesting is that the Apple version of the software contained a web server on your machine that even after you uninstalled Zoom, when you clicked on another link, this web server would help and reinstall the software again, and it was seamless.
Mm-hmm.
So the user didn't see it getting installed. Apple then this week, late this week, has pushed out an update that goes in, a silent update that goes in and removes this server from your machine.
Right, right. Now, this I find interesting as well. There's a person on Twitter. His name is Eric Capuano, and I think he captured this in this tweet. He said, InfoSec Twitter, how dare you silently install a vulnerable web server on my system? Also InfoSec Twitter, how dare you silently remove a vulnerable web server from my system?
Right.
Everyone else, I guess there was a bad thing that could turn on my camera, but it's gone now.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
So but what do you make of this? Some people pushing back on Apple's capability to silently alter your computer.
Right,
uninstall software from what they say are for security reasons, and in this case, that is absolutely true.
Correct.
What do you make of people getting spun up about that?
I don't know. I mean, I tend to think that when you buy an Apple device, you're going into the Apple ecosystem, right? And part of that ecosystem is they have a security culture, and they have the idea that the user is not really in control of their computer experience.
To the degree they are on other OSs.
Right. This is the main reason I don't like Apple. Mm-hmm. As a guy who comes from a technical background, I enjoy using a Windows machine or Linux machines.
Right.
I don't want the Apple experience. I don't want them telling me what to do. So if you don't want Apple behaving this way, don't buy an Apple.
Right.
Right. But the vast majority of people, just like this tweet says, have the attitude that, hey, there was something bad and Apple took care of it.
Yeah, we're right? good here.
We're good. We're done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that what really prompted Apple to do this was the fact that Zoom's web server didn't uninstall as part of the app uninstall.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably in violation of the developer agreement.
I would imagine so.
I don't know that it is. I'm not an app developer for Apple. And
yeah, it makes sense that it would.
Yeah.
It's just, it's bad form, if nothing else, to
right.
leave behind a web server running after your user has requested that your software be uninstalled.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. There's an article Zach Whitaker wrote over on TechCrunch, and part of it includes a quote from a spokesperson from Zoom who said, "We're happy to have worked with Apple on testing this update."
Right.
Yeah, I'm just guessing what that conversation was like.
Everybody's all grins over there, right?
Right. I'm just imagining Apple saying to, speculating here, but thinking that Apple's saying, okay, so here's what's going to happen.
Right.
And Zoom saying, okay, you're right. Yep, okay, very good. We're good.
You have a lot of computers that we want to have access to. So,
right.
Yep, okay.
Right.
I mean, this is, like I said, this is why you buy an Apple. You know,
yeah.
It's because of the security posture and because a lot of this maintenance, which would, you'd have to do yourself on other operating systems, is handled by Apple themselves.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's an interesting kerfuffle and certainly, I mean, it's a security event as well.
It is.
Yeah. All right. Well, Joe Kerrigan, as always, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure, Dave.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire Daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
And that's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. And for professionals and cybersecurity leaders who want to stay abreast of this rapidly evolving field, sign up for CyberWire Pro. It'll save you time and keep you informed. Listen for us on your Alexa smart speaker, too.
The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Elliot Peltzman, Peru Prakash, Stefan Vaziri, Kelsey Bond, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Iben, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpe, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here tomorrow. And now a word from our sponsor, SpyCloud, the leader in operationalizing cybercrime analytics. Traditional threat intelligence is a thing of the past. Cyber criminals are stealing vast amounts of credentials, session cookies, and financial data every day, and it's hard to keep up. SpyCloud is the trusted partner businesses turn to fully understand their darknet exposure risk and neutralize threats before it's too late. SpyCloud alerts your organization as soon as an employee or customer's data appears on the darknet, so you can act faster than bad actors to prevent cyber attacks like ransomware, session hijacking, account takeover, and online fraud. With insights from the industry's largest repository of recaptured data, protect the digital identities and systems most important to your business. Get your free corporate darknet exposure report at spycloud.com/cyberwire and see what information criminals have in their hands today. That's spycloud.com/cyberwire.